Today is the 23rd of January 2018. I'm interviewing Kevin Victor Watkins of Frimley Hastings. Kevin's going to tell us about his family's involvement in the Hawke's Bay history. Kevin has been a counsellor. So Kevin, would you like to tell me about the life and times of your family?
Yeah, thank you, Frank. Perhaps we might go back to the beginning of the recorded history that we have of the Watkins family. And that dates back to 1800, where the first Watkins we are aware of was in Hereford in the UK. He was an innkeeper and he had several children. One of those, William Watkins, became a watchmaker, and in the mid-1800s, he and his wife sailed for Australia. He became quite prominent in politics in Australia, becoming a member of parliament, and he continued in the trade of watchmaking, jewellery, and then he sold up those businesses in Collins Street in Melbourne, and he bought a series of hotels. So this is the continuation, I guess, of the Watkins and the hospitality industry. And that was to follow through in my father's later life. So the first child born to that Watkins family in Australia was my great-grandfather. And he was married in Australia, and shortly afterwards he and his wife shipped to New Zealand. They landed at Hokitika and took a trip across the Southern Alps during the middle of winter with young children, and that was quite a heroic feat. They set up home in Christchurch for a few years, moved to Dunedin for a couple of years, and then decided they would move up to the North Island. So they arrived here in Hastings, Napier area. So that great-grandfather was Edwin William Watkins and his wife Lucy, who are both buried in the Hastings Cemetery. They had quite a large family, and one of those children was my grandfather, Alf Watkins. Now, Alf passed away before I was born, so what I'm sharing now is just from written history that we do have. Yes. So Alf went through school. It seemed he had quite a mechanical interest from a young age. He joined the railways department, and he became a fireman on the first steam engine that travelled the main trunk line when it was opened. And I have a photo here of him and the crew standing beside that engine on the turntable somewhere over Central North Island, somewhere in that area.
That's where the turntable used to be.
So he was the fireman on the first engine that did that trip. So he worked for the railways for a few years. Then I noticed in 1911, he gained his certificate to allow him to drive traction engines and steam-driven equipment. So he got that 1911, and at that stage, I think he must have left the employ of the railways, and he started up his own business here in Hastings. Two of his sisters here had married two of the Powderall brothers. Now, Powderalls were a well-established family in the transport and farming industry. And my understanding, looking back through some of the old diaries, that the Powderall family lent my grandfather somewhere in the vicinity of £700 to buy his first traction engine. So that happened, and I see in the diaries that that was paid back in a matter of 2 years. So there was a lot of work going on, and we have a very lovely photo of Granddad and that engine in February 1914, moving what was the old Union Bank that sat on the corner of Karamu Road and Heratonga Street, and is now known as Willow Park Lodge and Willow Park Road. So Granddad was very involved in growing a contracting business, general cartage, moving of buildings, and in particular in the summer season, harvesting. He had his own thrashing mills and the gypsy wagons and the water carts, and All those were parked at his residence in Avenue Road West. 503, 505 were the two properties where he lived in Avenue Road West. So Grandad was doing very, very well, and then the First World War came along. He left New Zealand beginning of January 1916, and he was caught up in Belgium and Passchendaele and Ypres and some of those terrible battles, and he suffered from the German gas that they let go. Sure. So he came back to New Zealand at the end of 1917, a very unwell man. Anyway, I think about 3 years later, 2 years later, he married. His wife was a young lady from the Corbin family in Hastings, which were a well-established family. And they set up their home in Avenue Road. So those first years after the war, I can remember my grandma saying that during the summer months he would sleep outside the house in a little worry that was just big enough for a single bed, and he would cough his lungs out all night. It was terrible. But during that time he was still working. He set up his own workshop and he had lathes and milling machines, and he was very mechanical. He built a lot of equipment, repaired his own stuff. Mm. He was an interesting man. Not tall in stature, but certainly a good brain and a very good practical man. So that business grew and grew, and then we arrive at 1931. And February the 3rd, they are out thrashing in Tollemache Road when the earthquake struck. So of course, everything stopped there. And then they came into the town and saw what had happened, and there was an urgent cry for traction engines to come in and try and move rubble so they could get in and rescue survivors. So Grandad sent two engines in, and there are photographs of both those engines in amongst the rubble in Hastings. After the earthquake, in his diaries, there are several entries where he moved buildings out of the CBD to various places around the town, so that created more work for him. My dad, Victor William Watkins, was born in 1924, and in those early mid 30 years he spent every moment that he could with my granddad, and my dad developed a great understanding and empathy for machinery. When he was 11 years old, he was in charge of his first full gang out harvesting. Traction engine, mill, all the guys. 11 years old, Dad was in charge, and Granddad was somewhere else around the district with another gang. My dad recalled a story when he was 12 years old, bringing the traction engine and the mill back into Hastings late at night. They had been out Valley Road, Maraikākahu, and the engines on the roads made quite a rumbling noise, and it was very late and someone had rung the local traffic cop, whose name was Herbie Green, and Herbie Green was waiting for him in Maraikākahu Road, just on the town boundary. So my dad got a bit of a racking up about that. He said, well, he said, I can't leave the engine here, I've got to get it home. So he did get it home, and Granddad paid the ticket. Those were little things that happened. So after my dad left Hastings Boys High School, he worked at Stuart Greer Motors as a mechanic, and from there he went into the Air Force and served time at Ohakia as an Air Force mechanic. He didn't go overseas for service, he was based here in New Zealand as Air Force mechanic. Then he came back to Hastings and just took over whole contracting business. My granddad was very sick and he died in August 1945. My granddad had been an astute businessman. He'd bought properties in Frimley and he had quite a few other investments and shares. And when he died, my father and his brother Len were left land in Frimley and what in those days would be considered a useful amount of cash to sort of make a good start in life. So my dad built the family home in 402 Waikanui Road, married my mum in 1946, and I came along, the only child, in 1949. So at the family home in Waikanui Road, we had 3/4 acre. 1/4 acre was the house, and the other 1/2 acre was the yard. So in those first years, the traction engines were there, and the house shifting trailers, which were really made of just big hardwood beams, steel U-bolts. The wheels were wooden, inside steel casings.
Yeah.
Very, very basic, but by gosh, they worked. Yeah. Amazing. Anyway, after the war, a lot of ex-World War II machinery ended up in New Zealand. And my dad went down to an auction in Trentham. I guess this is probably about 1950-51. And there were some ex-British Guy trucks. They were six-wheel vehicles, four-cylinder engines, petrol engines, about 70 horsepower. So my dad bought one of these to replace the traction engine. And once it got home and used it the first time, he said, steam's gone. So the traction engines were just sent to Japan. This one's went to Japan. He said, no, not getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to light fires, but I can just go out and turn a crank handle and I'm ready to go. So he had a truck, but he still had the old wooden transporter. So he thought, well, I've got to do something about this. So in 1953, he went back to Trentham, and they had in the compound there an American Jahn tank transporter from the war. The army said, no, they couldn't possibly sell it to him. So I think S.I. Jones was the MP at that time. Yeah. So Dad went round to see MP Jones and told him the transporter was no good sitting in a yard in Trentham doing nothing when it could be here in Hastings doing a lot of work. So apparently MP Jones went back to Wellington and had discussions. And my dad ended up buying that transporter. He brought it back to Hastings and he modified it, increased its length, it became a telescopic unit. And I can still remember as a little boy, and I would have been 4 years old, at night time the welders would come in to do all the welding and the sky would light up with the flare from the welding torches. Well, at that time radios weren't like radios today. And every time the welding torch started, it interfered with all the radios in the neighbourhood. And while my dad was down the backyard doing this with the guys, my mum was taking phone calls from my great neighbours saying, tell Vic Watkins to turn that bloody welder off because we can't hear our radios. This went on for about 4 months. Anyway, the job was done. And Dad ended up with the biggest transporter this side of Wellington in the south and Hamilton in the north. It was a very big unit. So I grew up with a dad who was full-time shifting houses, moving anything that needed to be moved, pulling anything out that was stuck, pulling over big trees, boats that got washed up that had to be transported back to be repaired. And although I was an only child, it was a really exciting childhood because I love machinery and, you know, at night time I'd always wait outside on the roadside waiting for my dad to come home with the transporter, and that was always a very, very big thrill. So I grew up all amongst that stuff. The other thing I need to say about my dad was he was an immensely physically strong and powerful man, incredibly strong. And when you're shifting houses, well, in those days, it was all hard work. There was no hydraulics. It was all physical hard work. And so my dad had a whole stack of huge telephone poles, which were Malayan hardwoods. Some of those were 40 foot long, and they would be 12 inches square at the big end, and they'd taper down to about 8 inches square at the light end. And these would sit across the transporter, and the houses that he moved would sit on these big beams. Sure. Well, in latter years, some of the workers who worked for my dad would say, there'd be three of us guys on the light end, and we'd be struggling to move these beams. And they said, your old man had put his arms round the big end, and he'd swing that beam round, and he'd say, what are you guys doing on the light end? And he said, we'd be struggling. He said, our knees would be bent, our backs would be bent. And your old man, he said, he'd just toss this thing around. Well, I heard many stories from many different guys who worked with my dad over the years. And I saw the physical size of his body. And that played out again in the Highland Games in Hastings, because my dad was a competitor in tossing the sheave and tossing the caber. And no one could compete with him tossing the caber. And they had a challenge cup there, which I think he won 10 years. And people used to crowd around to watch Vic Watkins pick up the big caber. And they had two. They had a standard caber for everybody else, and the big one that was for Vic Watkins. And there was sort of a bit of an awe about that. And as a little fella, I was pretty proud of my dad, because he was someone pretty special. So my dad did some jobs that were pretty outstanding, even by New Zealand standards, considering the limitation of the gear that he had. In 1956, he moved the big two-storied Little Sisters of the Poor home in Worsley Street. So that's a huge two-storied house, stucco building. He moved that in one piece, back and across on the section, so they could rebuild the new buildings that are currently there. That was one job that was his pride and joy. The other job he did just before he finished actually contracting in the Hawke's Bay, a large fishing boat named the Genco 3 ran aground down at Castle Point out from Masterton, and it was very badly hulled, and they said it couldn't be salvaged. Big boat, it was nearly 70 foot long, and it lay in the sand for 2 years and really got buried. All you could see was just the cabin sticking out. Anyway, my dad was talking to the owner of the boat one day, and my dad said, oh, he said, nothing's too big a challenge for me. He said, we better go and have a look at it. So they went down to Masterton and out to the coast, and my dad said, yeah, he said, I can bring this boat back, and he said, I'll deliver it into your boatyard for repair. No cure, no pay. So if it doesn't get there, it doesn't cost you anything. So my dad built a special transporter, went down there, and they dug this big boat out of the sand, winched it up above high tide, loaded it up on this transporter, and then I came with him. We brought the boat back from Wairarapa to Napier. That was a huge job. And the Ministry of Transport said, well, we just don't think it can be done. We don't think it can get over the roads. My dad measured everything. He said, I will get it over the roads. And we came round corners there where just literally inches to spare, and bridges we scraped over. When we were coming from Paiatua to Woodville, it was too big to go over the bridge, so we had to pull it through the Manawatu River. So we had D8 bulldozers as anchors and the Scammel winching it through there. So that was another job that he was immensely proud of, because everyone else said it couldn't be done.
Yes, that was the thing that started him, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It can't be done.
It can't be done. In my dad's psyche, everything could be done. It's just a matter of working out how you do it. And Frank, my dad had a knack with machinery. He could almost hear a machine's heartbeat. He'd get 100% out of it, and then he'd get another 10%. And he was just great to watch. He'd look at something, think about it, then he'd lay out what he needed to do, and he would do it. So about 1973, he sold up the business, sold the properties in Hastings, and he moved down to the Wairarapa, to a little country town called Tanui, and he bought his first hotel there.
That's saloon country, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yes, yes. So when we started this conversation, you know, the earliest Watkins we know about in Hereford was in the tavern industry, and then the Watkins come out to Melbourne, and they're in the hotel industry, and here we skip another two or three generations, and my dad's back in the hospitality industry. And that's where he stayed, in that hospitality industry, moving around the country. He retired in Taupo, and he just retired a year. And he phoned me up one evening, and he said, oh, he said, I've just been had a bit of a spit. And he said, it's red. He said, I don't like the look of that. So I said, well, you better go to the doctor, Dad. So he came through here and saw Sid Young, been an old mate. And Sid said, oh, he said, look, we'll have a look, Vic. Just have a look down the gullet. Anyway, they did that, and Sid said, well, Vic, he said, you've got 6 months. He said, it's in the gullet, in the stomach. He said, we can't do anything about it. Now, he told Dad that on, was about the 3rd of January, and Dad died on the 1st of February. It was 4 weeks, as quickly as that.
Oh, and the only symptoms he had were coughing some blood.
Yeah. So he was living in Taupo by himself at that stage. So we brought him back to Hastings, and he stayed with us, and he died in our home. So that was the end of the era of Vic Watkins. In terms of my own life, I went to Frimley School. I was the first child born in what was then the new maternity home, which my dad had shifted from. It was Frimley, the Green Homestead, virtually opposite the hospital store shops. And he shifted that round the back, and there was an entrance and off Canning Road. That became the new maternity wing. And I understand I was the first child born in that wing. Or was it my sister? I had a sister born in 1955 who was stillborn. I correct it, it was my sister. She was the first born there. Sadly, she died there. So I went to Frimley School, and I loved my time at Frimley School.
How big a school was it those days?
About 8 classrooms. So there were 4 primer classrooms at the back and 4 standard classrooms in the front. Les Bradley was the first headmaster, followed by Frank Cutler. Anyway, those were lovely days, and it was just a very short walk out the back of Frimley School down Eichner Road to the home. So from Frimley School, I graduated as a first day pupil at the new Herotonga Intermediate, which was opened in 1960, and those were 2 great years. And then from Herotonga Intermediate to Hastings Boys High School, and I was there 5 years. Became a bit of a rat bag at Hastings Boys High School, but never got myself caned. I did stand at the bottom of the stairs on several occasions, sweating blood, but never actually got myself caned. But I look back now and think, oh, those school years were the great years of our lives. So I left high school, worked with my dad for a year, shifting houses. Then my dad sold up, moved to the Wairarapa, and my first job out in the big wide world was with the Hawke's Bay Farmers Motor Company in Queen Street, and I was employed to work in the parts department. So I was in the parts department for 2 years, and then I moved into the administration department. And in the 3 or 4 years prior to that, I'd been very involved with the young people's group at St Matthew's Anglican Church in Hastings. So in 1970, I actually went to St John's Theological College in Auckland, because I thought, well, this might be my vocation in the ordained ministry. Had a great year there. Academically wasn't very successful, but everything else was pretty successful.
Yes.
Loved that year, one of the great years of my life. But at the end of that year, I thought, no, I'm too much a practical sort of guy out in the wide world. So I came back to Hawke's Bay Farmers Motor Company, and shortly after that, they merged with Bailey Motors.
So where was the Hawke's Bay Motor Company?
It's in Queen Street, where the old Briscoe's building is. You've got Hawke's Bay Farmers Co-op Association on the corner. If you come back west, there's an old building with a curved roof. That was the Hawke's Bay Farmers Motor Company. So they were General Motors agents. It was a division Hawke's Bay Farmers Co-op. So with the merger of the two companies, I was transferred down to the Bailey Motors site, and I spent... Well, I was there till the late 1970s, and then while I was there, I had purchased another Scammel from the army. I still had Dad's transporter, and people still wanted buildings moved. So I'd start my day at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd go knocking out chimneys of buildings that had to be moved. Come home at 7:30, jump in the shower, dress up with a white shirt and tie. And then I'd do my 8 hours at Bailey Farmers, then scream home, get into my old clothes, and back out preparing houses for removal. And then when it was time to move a house, I'd say to them, I just need half a day off, I need the morning off. So we'd move a house, and then daylight morning or evening, weekends, we'd put the foundations and get the job done. Probably spent 2 years doing that, but it was totally impractical, totally impossible. Yeah. Then the boss said one day, look, Keon, he said, I think you'd better make up your mind whether you want to shift houses or you want to be here. And I said, look, shifting houses is really in my heart, so I think it's time to go. So that's what I did, and went full-time shifting houses and boats and pulling trees, all those things that I'd done with my dad. The only thing I didn't do was get involved in harvesting. because my dad in those early 40s, 50s and 60s in summertime, he had mechanical threshing mills, and he would go out threshing in the summertime and I would go out with him. But I didn't follow that in later life. So I shifted many houses and buildings and churches in the Hawke's Bay district, but predominantly Hastings and Napier. And then we had the opportunity at the time of the new millennium. I saw a window of opportunity to claim a little bit of fame for the Watkins family. Seeing we had been involved in shifting houses and changing the face of Hastings for three generations. So at midnight, on the stroke of midnight 2000, I moved a house in Percival Road in Hastings, which belonged to the Hill family, Ted and Jean Hill. And because we were in daylight saving time, we repeated that move on the stroke of 1 a.m. just to make sure that we couldn't technically be tripped up. So we did that without permits, without any police escorts. We unlawfully blocked the road so no other traffic could come down it. And we had nice professional signs made to put on the building to say this was the first building moved in the world in the new millennium. Mm. So that was just a little opportunity we took, a little claim to fame. I feel quite proud about that. Yes. So carried on shifting buildings, and then local government had always been of some interest to myself. My dad had quite a lot to do with the borough council and then the city council, talking with councillors of the day and the mayors of the day, and I always felt quite a love for Hastings. I thought it was a special place. And so local government elections 2001, I thought, I'm going to have a go. I could be a councillor, I could shift houses, this would work quite well. So I put my name in the hat, and very luckily I was elected. I was the second highest poller of that election in 2001. So I carried on moving houses, and then it very quickly became apparent that I wasn't going to be able to wear two hats. So I thought, I've got to do one thing successfully and let one thing go. And the local government was a big interest. So sure. I thought, well, I've done the house shifting. I feel like I've kept the family tradition going. I can let that go. And so that's what happened. And as at today, I'm in my sixth term as a councillor. Yeah, so it was good. So anyway, in my personal life, I met my first wife, Denise Black, about 1972. She was the daughter of Jack Black, who was the manager of Bailey Farmers, Havelock North. We were married at St Matthew's in 1974, and we had three sons, Mark, Jono and Bradley. Mark and Jono are still living in the Hastings district. The youngest son, Bradley, is a helicopter pilot, and he traverses oceans all around the world on fishing boats. He flies off the deck on the helicopters and fish spotters. So my eldest son Mark has two granddaughters, Olivia and Jessie. Both those girls are now going to Woodford House. The middle son Jono has one son, little Ralphie, who's just 1 year old. And Brad hasn't married or any family at this stage. So when we were married, we lived in Frimley. We lived in a little flat in Nottingley Road for 2 years. Then I bought a property in Ballantyne Place with the old homestead on it. Did that up, spent about 3 years doing that up, and I moved that house out to Clive, and I bought a much more modern homestead off the Hedgeley estate in Bayview, and I moved that home.
Well, that was the Holt.
Yes. I moved that home onto the property in Ballantyne Place, and that's where we lived. And then about 1990, maybe less, 1990, bought a 5-acre property in Lyndhurst Road. So we lived there, we had an orchard, stone fruit orchard, and then things weren't too good, so the family split up, and Lyndhurst property was sold, and I moved and bought a property where we are now, Bikanui Place. About 2015, I met a lovely young lady by the name of Karina. And that was an amazing set of coincidences how that happened, but that would probably take too long for this recording, I think.
No, it wouldn't, actually.
Okay. Well, during my time on council, I've been very involved with the China Connection, Hastings, Wayland, and the Greater China Collection. And that has become one of my major portfolios. 2013, a big busload of Chinese people who lived in Auckland and who were members of the Catholic community in Auckland had bussed down to Hawke's Bay for a weekend, a long weekend. The organiser of the tour had supposedly made all the arrangements with someone here to book accommodation, itinerary, sightseeing and all those things. And it seems the busload of people arrived in Napier. They stopped and the tour leader rang this lady and said, look, we're here with the bus, where do we stay? And the lady said, well, I haven't actually heard any more from you, so I've done nothing about it. So here's a bus of 48 people. So somehow the lady on the bus was given the Napier City Council number to phone. So in a blind panic, she phoned Napier City Council. And they apparently said, look, we can't help you, but there's a councillor in Hastings by the name of Kevin Watkins who deals with Chinese. I'll give you his number. So Friday afternoon, I'm just driving back home and the phone goes. I pull over and here's this lady and she says, look, I'm in a terrible predicament. She said, I'm in a bus with 48 people. We've got no accommodation. Don't know what we're going to do here for the next 3 days. Is there any way you could suggest something? I said, look, just tell the bus driver, stay where he is, get out of the bus, get some fresh air, give me 10 minutes. So I rang the Anderson, Graham. I said, Graham, look, we've got an emergency. I said, do you reckon you can put 48 people up for 3 nights? He said, yeah, we can do it. So I rang back and I said, look, bring the bus to Hastings, to the Anderson. I will be there to meet you. So the bus duly came over, everyone got off, and I said, look, if you've got no itinerary, I'm happy to come on the bus with you for the next 3 days, and I'll show you everything you need to see. So we did that, and we had a wonderful time. It was a brilliant trip. So these people go back to Auckland and they say, look, if you ever come to Auckland, just let us know. We'll be at the airport waiting for you. We'll take you to lunch and blah, blah, blah. So anyway, a few months later, I did go back to Auckland and I rang the tour organiser who was on the bus. And she met me and we went to a restaurant and here were some of the others from that group and we had a dinner. That was good. Lovely. So I thought that's the end of the story. But it wasn't. The following December, this is a year later, December the 31st, I'm meant to be flying to China. In the morning, I hadn't felt too bright. So I went to my doctor and I said, Colin, I said, I'm flying to China tonight, but I'm not actually feeling too bright. So he said, oh, look, we better just give you a check-up at the hospital. So I whip into the hospital straight after lunch and they give me a check over and they said, oh, the liver's not too great. We think you need to stay here. And I said, well, look, I've got to be at the airport at Napier because I'm flying to Auckland, flying out to China tonight. And I said, look, you're not flying to China. Oh, what's going on here? So anyway, they monitored me till about 6 o'clock at night and they said, well, look, everything sort of looks all right. You're not going to China, but go home. You know? So I went home. Been home about 10 minutes and my phone goes. And it's the lady who was the tour organiser on the bus. Oh, Kevin, she said, I'm in Hastings with 3 friends. We've just arrived and we're going to spend New Year's night here in a couple of days. Do you think you'd like to catch up with us and perhaps show us around? I thought, oh, God, nights, you know. I thought, oh, well, I better do it. So I said, yeah, look, I'll do that. So I jumped in the car, go down and meet them, and they're staying at a motel in Windsor Avenue, meet the 3 friends, and one of the friends was this delightful Malaysian lady.
Uh-huh.
So the next 2 days, I take them round everywhere. We go to the orchards and we buy fruit and we dine out. And we have a lovely time. I did sort of just keep looking at this one lady and I thought, gosh, she's always smiling. She always looks happy. What a lovely lady. Never thought any more about it. But I did say to her before she left, I said, look, do you mind if we'll swap phone numbers? You know, if ever you come back to Hastings, give me a ring. Perhaps if I go to Auckland, give you a call. So we did that. And it was a few months later, I was going back to Auckland. So I phoned this lady, Karina. And I said, look, I don't know anything about you. Are you married, family, or anything like that? No, no. She said, I've never been married. She said, I've been in Auckland 8 years. I'm living here. She said, my sister's married with a family. She lives just around the corner. And she said, I work at a daycare. And I said, look, I'm coming up to Auckland to a conference, and there's a conference dinner. I said, would you like to come to the dinner with me? She said, oh, I'd be more than happy to do that. That's fine. So we did that, and it was lovely, and it was purely a friendship, a friendship. And anyway, I'm sort of here by myself, and I thought, wow, this is sort of lovely lady. And she speaks Cantonese and Mandarin, and my deep involvement with China, you know, there could be some meshing of some cogs here. Mm. So one thing led to another, and we saw a little bit more of each other, and Karina came down here and had a look at Hastings, and then we decided, well, she's living by herself, I'm living by myself. Mm. We thought we could get together and make a nice family again.
A lovely story, actually.
Yeah. So it was an amazing coincidence. The bus, that the arrangements weren't made. I was meant to be going to China, and the hospital put the kibosh and said, you're not going to China, you're staying here. This lady happened to pick Karina to come with her to Hastings. So it is a lovely story, and that's a story I'm really happy to share.
Yes, you spoke earlier about your grandfather married a paladin.
Corbin. Granddad married a Corbin, but two of his sisters married two Powderal brothers.
That's right. So you've been involved with the Hastings District Council now, you said, for this your 18th year?
2001, so 17 years.
I've seen you on the front of Father Christmas every year and at Blossom Festivals.
Yeah, you're right, Frank. We'll talk about Father Christmas first, and that goes back to my dad. My dad was a member of the Home Servicemen's Association here in Hastings, and every year, just before Christmas, my dad would get an old canvas canopy and put on the back of his truck, and they'd throw an old couch in the back. And then one of the members would dress up as Father Christmas, sit on the couch. Alan Hughes, who owned Columbus Radio, was a member. So he'd bring down a speaker and an amp, and they'd wire all that up. Fred Sullivan, who was, I think he was the boss of the milk treatment station, he would bring cartons of old aluminium-coloured top offcuts. So on the Friday night, before they would go around visiting all the members, the guys would come round home into the shed. We get the canopy on, throw some of this tinsel on, big sign on the side that says Home Servicemen's Association, put the couch in the back. By this time it was 9 o'clock, and then the whiskies had come out and everything else, and the guys would have a bit of beer up. Then on the Saturday morning, about 9 o'clock, Santa would be dressed up. He'd get on the back of the deck, sitting on a couch, and there'd be a padded carton of Frosty Jack ice cream tubs and some lollies, and there were a couple of other chairs, and I would often go on the rounds. So they'd drive round to each home serviceman member's home, and a loudspeaker would go, Father Christmas is here, Father Christmas is here. The kids would come out, get their ice cream and their lollies, and it was a tradition that the family invited Father Christmas in for a cup of tea and a little piece of cake. Well, I can remember, Frank, in the morning it always was cups of tea and a bit of cake. But after midday, it was something a little stronger. And by the time we got to about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I suspect everyone was very well lubricated. Because I know Dad was driving the truck an awful lot faster than what he was in the morning. And the ho-ho-ho's were an awful lot louder than what they were in the morning. But what I remembered and what has always stuck with me was the thrill of Father Christmas actually going to people's homes and walking in their front gate. Now, at that time in Hastings, and you might remember this, Roaches used to have a Santa grotto at the back of the shop. And hundreds of people, families, would go in at night and you'd walk to the grotto. So that was one way of seeing Father Christmas. This was an alternate way, that Santa was coming to your home. Previous to that, I'd been involved in some of the Christmas parades in Hastings, and I made Christmas floats. I had a little bit of creative flair. But around 2000, I said, right, I'm going to build a float on the back of my little trailer that we can tow around. and we'll just drive past people's houses, not stop, we're just going to drive around. So I built this little float with three Christmas candles, and there was no Father Christmas, and we drove around, and gosh, people were looking up and waving and smiling, and cars were tooting. I thought, well, this thing actually could progress. So the next year, I built a better sleigh on a bigger trailer. We still didn't have any reindeer, but my mate Ross Sweatman said, oh, he said, I'll dress up as Father Christmas and sit on it. So we did this, and we got more toots and waves. So I said to Ross, look, Ross, there's nothing like this in Hastings. The Christmas parades had stopped. There was nothing in the shops. Let's make this something for Hastings. So we purchased two reindeer, lovely model reindeer, and we built a back on the float with some organ pipes, and we coloured it up, and we had some music. So we went round streets and schools, and oh, the response was greater again. So I came home and said, Ross, we've only got two reindeer. I said, we need something a bit more spectacular. So we were gifted another four reindeer by a very generous gentleman in Hastings, and he saw the value to the community. So we built another sleigh, and we built the float a little bit bigger, and so now we had six reindeer. So we did that for about 3 years, and then we got one more reindeer to have seven, and we built the float that we've got now. I'd have to say that's probably one of the most exciting things I have done to generate community interaction and response. People, when they hear the music, they just flock out onto the footpaths. The kids are dancing, dancing. Yes. It's just a...
This year, about two or three weeks before Christmas, I got a ring from Tremaine's, who I worked for 24 years, and they said, I'd like you to be Father Christmas. They had a Santa's cave in the Havelock office, dressed up beautifully. It was only five or six nights, two-hour stints, but it was so hot.
I don't think it's the last year for you.
It is, actually. No, I'm 81 now.
Look, Frank, we do about 1,800 kilometres just driving around the streets of Hastings. That's what we clock up over the 4 weeks. We have had some pretty tearful experiences with people, and we've had some pretty horrible experiences. Mm. We've been bottled by the mongrel mob, beer bottles, and that's not nice when beer bottles are smashing on the float and on the road, and these guys are tearing after you, and you don't know, your life's in danger. We've had that, and we've had tearful moments where we've gone to visit people who are very close to the end of their life, and the joy that that's brought to them, and just the magic moments. We have unashamedly cried ourselves, and the people who've been there have cried. So it's just one of those moments in time in your life where everything comes together. So I've often thought, well, we've done Father Christmas long enough, perhaps we should stop. But my mate Ross about June, he says, well, I'm just thinking what we're going to do this year on the float.
Is he still being Father Christmas?
He's been my sole Father Christmas from year one.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So, yeah, we've appeared on national television, and the tens of thousands of photos that have been taken, and many of those by international tourists. Whenever I see a tourist take a photo of the float, I just feel happy, because I think somewhere in the world they are going to go home and they're going to show their photos to their family, and they'll look at that Father Christmas and think, well, that was in Hastings, New Zealand. So I feel pretty happy about that. So that was the Christmas thing, and the Blossom Parade floats. Again, this is a follow-on from my dad. In the 50s and 60s, we would always help Thodey's Orchard make their floats. Doug Thodey. So Doug Thodey always made a natural blossom float. Thodey's and Purnell's were the two who really went for natural blossoms. So I remember working late at nights, Friday nights, on a Thodey float. And then I started building floats about, probably the mid-1990s. And I've had a reasonable amount of success. I think I've won Best in Parade five times.
Well, it's pretty good.
And I love it, because to me, the Blossom Parade is Hastings. This is what brought Hastings people together, the Fruit Bowl of New Zealand. And we celebrated it with a Blossom Parade. So I look forward to that, and I'll be building a float for this year's.
Now, you mentioned Waylin. You've been very involved as the council's rep on that for some time now. Would you just like to say a few words about that?
Yeah, really, from the first year I was elected on council, 2001, I'd always been interested in the sister city relationship, because as you know, Frank, that was the first New Zealand-China relationship signed in 1981. So when I got on council, I wanted to immerse myself to understand more about the relationship. I went to China the first time with a council delegation in 2004, not really knowing what to expect. Sure. I had a mental image of what China sure. would be like. When I went to China, it turned that mental image completely upside down. And I really just fell in love with the people. The most warm-hearted, generous, kind people. And I was lucky enough to see some of the beauty of the culture, and I fell in love with that.
Sure.
And I guess in lots of ways that changed my life. I came back here with this very real life experience of China and trying to balance in my mind what we had here and what we take for granted.
Yes.
And yeah, that has certainly coloured my life since then. So I've immersed myself in the relationship, some would say too deeply, but I don't think so. I've been to China 14 times now. But from the political point of view around our council table, I don't think I'm exaggerating to say I've been the person who has actually driven the relationship and made sure the wheels and the cogs were oiled and turned. And I've been the one who's burnt the midnight candle and done the long hours to make sure things happen. And I guess an extension of that is the lighting of the Chinese garden for that week every year. That's something that's really special. And what struck me, Frank, was I had the opportunity to visit many secondary schools in China, and I saw the work ethic and the time that they put into education. And I came back here and I thought, well, the Chinese young people are smart. Education is their number one goal, and they'll work 23 hours a day, 7 days a week to achieve. And I looked at our kids and I looked at my own kids. I thought, you know, our kids are going to be competing against these kids before too long. And so I need to try and make our students aware of what their competitors are going to be like. So I arranged a series of projects, and the object of those projects was to let our secondary school students understand the history, the culture, the education, and to create some interaction. Those projects have been pretty successful. And the last one, 2015, was called the Amazing China Face Race. That involved our students having to identify one person in the whole of China. So 1.36 billion people. They had to find one person, and all they had was that person's face. So we designed the competition to give them a little bit of a helping hand by taking them through every province in China, learning about that province, its political side, the economy side, the history, the culture. And eventually, they would come to one province where this face could be found. That was a pretty successful program which won national honours here, was picked up by the Chinese news media as something totally unique. They'd never heard of anything like this. And Hastings got television publicity that we would never, ever, ever be able to buy. They sent television teams out here that filmed in our secondary schools that are trying to get international students from China. They filmed the hinterlands, they filled the plains, our produce. And we had two programs shown at New Year, two 25-minute programs on Chinese New Year, the biggest viewing audience of the year, for free. Two 25-minute showcasing Hastings.
That's amazing, yes.
Things you can do. So we're doing another one of these projects this year, 2018, and we've chosen a face. And the China Culture Centre, which is part of the Ministry of Culture in Beijing, they're onto it, so they're in behind us. And all the sponsorship virtually is coming from the China end to make this thing work. So this is sort of the flow-on effect from the Guilin sister-city relationship.
So what do you do to relax?
What do I do to relax? Well, I guess my relaxation has really been doing more in the China area.
Sure.
But look, I love to go out and sit on the beach with my fishing rod. I guess I'm a keen fisherman, but I don't get out too often. I love trout fishing in Taupo, and I haven't been on the lake for 6 years. But I can go out to the beach here with my rod, cast out, sit down in my chair, and within 5 minutes, everything in my mind is gone. So it's just a total refuel, refresh,
and
relax.
Are you successful?
I have been known to catch the odd fish, Frank.
That's being honest.
But I love my gardening, you know, I love my lawns, I love my gardening, yes. And Karina and I, we like to go out occasionally and we'll enjoy a coffee and walk around the shops and, yeah, just enjoy a good life.
So, is there anything you've forgotten to tell me?
There's about 6 hours of things I've forgotten to tell you, Frank.
I've still got plenty of tape.
You've still got plenty of tape. I think we should talk about the years of harvesting with my dad.
Yes, that's quite unique because a lot of people wouldn't even know what a tin mill was, apart from those of us that stood on them in the dust. And
yes, yeah. So my dad's initial threshing experience was with the traction engines and the old box mills and the horses, you know, bringing all the hay in and the hay stacks and the dust and grime. Well, my dad moved out of that and he bought a stationary case baler and he bought 62 model international tractor drawn pickup harvesters. Now the old case baler, I think there were two guys sitting on the end of it. One guy would be feeding in the top and there were shuttles that they would put in and then they'd have to push wires through really quickly and tie the wires up. And if you didn't get the shuttles quite right, you'd end up with a big bale or a smaller bale. Most of the harvesting I can remember was done in Evenden Road for Laurie Sweeney. And I would go out with my dad in the morning and I would always be on the mill. And it was a two-bag mill and we had a nice piece of, I guess it was almost 4x4 remu or mattai with a pointed end, and that was your rammer. And you would stand on the back there in the dust and you'd ram and ram one bag, and when that got full you'd switch over so the seed would fall into the other bag. The full bag you'd pull off and you'd grab your big needle and your string, put it through and a couple of wraps around the ear and then a few stitches and a couple of wraps around the other end. And you'd throw that on the tray that you could tip off appropriate point. My job was sort of watching and helping where I could until I got old enough to be able to ram and sew the bags myself. And they were, God, they were hot days. But Laurie Sweeney at lunchtime, we were always invited into the home and there'd be a lovely big hot meal cooked for us. And then we'd go out again and I think we could only probably thrash about 10 acres a day. That was about it. But I remember we'd come home, dirty, dusty, tired, go to sleep, wake up in the morning, and I couldn't prise my eyes open. They were good. So I'd feel my way down the hallway to the bathroom, get the taps on, and you'd spend a couple of minutes just washing your eyes till you could finally pull one open. And then you're off for another day's harvesting. I do remember one incident. It was a little bit naughty, really, but I was bagging on the mill and Laurie Sweeney, the owner, was driving around in a Ferguson tractor with a steel tray on the back, and he would pick up the bags and put on the tray and drive them off. And I'd obviously sewn up a very lightweight bag. And I watched Laurie sort of pick this bag up and he turned round and he was shaking a fist at me. And that was the message, that the bag was too light. So I thought, well, I'd better do a heavy bag. Right. So we went round and round the paddock, and while I was flicking other bags off, there was one bag that I just kept ram and ram and ram and ram and ram. And I rammed this bag so tight you wouldn't get another seed in it. Well, I couldn't actually get it off the frame. So I struggled and I sewed this bag up. Well, I couldn't even move it, so I let it fall. I was trying all my strength just to get it onto the tray, and I finally got it onto the tray, tipped it off onto the ground, and then I watched Laurie come along with the Fergie, and he pulled up beside the bag and he jumped off and he had a little two claw thing and he bent down and he put it in and he went to pull it up. Well, Laurie stopped. The bag never moved off the ground. He turned around and I can still see that fist. So that was one of those naughty things.
Well, it was a battle all the time. I remember this happening on mills with sacks of seed with rye corn. You could ram one so tight that two men could hardly lift it off the ground because they were big double stripers.
Oh, big bales.
So what sort of tractor did you draw that?
Dad's first tractor was he bought a new Fordson tractor. That would be about maybe 49, 50.
So that would be an E27N.
Big wheel. He bought that tractor to help demolish the Red Bridge. My dad demolished the old wooden Red Bridge, and that was about 49-50.
Yes, I rode over the new concrete bridge. I interviewed the guy who was one of the designers of the Red Bridge last week.
Gosh. Well, Dad pulled the old one down, sold all the timber, and he made a lot of money.
Big timber.
Yeah. So that was his first tractor and mill. Then he bought another 62 International mill and a McCormick International W9, and that was my tractor. Yeah, so as a young fellow, I moved from bagging to driving. Oh, I was only young, but we'd drive down the road together. I'd follow Dad. Pass a traffic cop, you'd only look at the front guy. So those were great harvesting days.
Oh, absolutely. There's photos of all the men standing in front of the box mill, all in their worsted trousers and all wearing waistcoats. They weren't sissies, so that was in the heat of summer.
Well, in our day, it was just shorts, bare body and shorts. We turned black, you know, very, very dark. And who knows, that might have been the wrong thing he did, because he did have a cancerous mole taken off his back in the late 60s.
They all smoked, a lot of them. Did your father smoke?
Oh, my dad. There's not a photo I've got of my dad without a cigarette in his mouth.
There are other reasons for getting the allergy, aren't there?
So my grandfather built a small box mill himself, and the quality of seed that came out of it was exceptionally high. It had quite a reputation. And they were doing some thrashing out at Munga Territory in a field opposite the nine-hole golf course. So they left the mill there that night. They'd finished the work, left the mill there that night, and about 3 hours later I got a phone call to say the mill's gone up in fire. And then someone said, we saw Percy Pilcher just driving past there not long before the phone call.
Yes.
Now apparently there's a fair bit of competition between my granddad and Percy
yes.
Pilcher, and this mill was getting a name for itself as being an exceptional
yes.
mill. And the family always believed
that Percy
might have put a candle in it. Just to, whether there's any truth in that or
no
not, I don't know.
Know.
But that's just one of those.
That would have been in Wed's paddock that the mill would have been.
Well, apparently, years afterwards, many years afterwards, when they turned it over, they'd find odd bolt and nut and a little bit of steel from the fire. Yes, that was quite interesting.